there, and welcome to the Thank You Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, and Dan Van Voris. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here on the Thinking Fellows. It's been a while since I've been on this show, but it's great to be back.
Yeah, I think the last time you were on was in the fall, before Here We Stand, I want to say.
I believe it was even prior to that. It was actually recorded in the old
garage.
Mm. That was the last time I was on the show.
That's the one I remember, yeah.
Yeah, I did one on apocalypticism and one on Johann Arndt.
Yeah.
Now, I understand. Oh. I was doing another podcast
and
at the time.
Jay Gresh,
15,
Machen,
17,
too.
And Machen. You're right. Yeah. Now, I did was doing another podcast at the time, Virtue in the Wasteland, for 15, 17. Now, that's over, and so...
Jeff,
great time. Great to be hanging out with you guys.
And yeah, have a headset back on. It's
yeah,
feel good.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I wanted to, so we are picking back up the History of the Reformation series that we've been doing. We took a little break about 3 weeks ago to do a Q&A, and we're back in sort of the swing of things here. But I wanted you to take a second to plug the academy you did on a very similar topic. You did a short history of the Reformation Academy.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things we do at 1517 in terms of just creating content and giving it out is we have the 1517 Academy. And the Academy has had a number of classes on philosophy and apologetics, and most recently, a class on the history of the Reformation. It's a very brief class that has a video component and a podcast component, an online quiz, and it was a lot of fun to do. It's a four-week course, and it just kind of introduces you to the big picture, sort of what was happening before the Reformation. What were some of the big themes across Europe during the Reformation? And we introduce it as kind of, a crash course. Someone who wants to maybe brush up, or someone who maybe didn't get that class in college that might want to learn a little bit about it.
Yeah, and I'll have it linked up in the show notes, as usual, with the resources. I highly suggest going in and doing that, because even if you don't, say, finish the course in a day or something like that, or a couple days, you have been doing occasionally some live Q&A with that course.
That's part of the academy. Is from time to time we have classes that are called synchronous, classes that take place at the same time. You like that word, Adam? That it's the same time it takes place with the instructor online and the person taking it at home. And so there's an opportunity for some interaction between the professor. I did it for a while. Our next class with Chad Bird will also have an element of that, and you can look forward to that. Check out 1517 Academy, and I think
Adam and I are now sweating, wondering if for the next class of ours we're going to have to do synchronous classes. Was this part of the deal?
We said synchronous classes, not syncretist classes. Want to be careful. We'll talk. It's, an element of maybe some Q&A at
why do you think they call it synchronous as opposed to just live?
Live at the same time? I don't know. You know, I started using the word and it just made sense.
Yeah.
It just
synchronous
and asynchronous. And so,
education.
Yeah.
This is just speculating. This is getting off whatever our episode topic is going to be. But the live seems to be for like Facebook. Instagram live things. So when you're talking about
that's social
maybe
media,
you want to
Adam.
Separate yourself a little bit.
Facebook, that's social media.
Also means you're not doing it at the same time. Okay. What you're doing is you're doing, it's not necessarily I'm at the computer the same time you are, but say in the same four-week span, we'll be interacting around the same time, not always necessarily face-to-face. But it's not just something you take and it's out in the, in the ether.
And then, so we are, Think Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network. And we are, in fact, launching a new show that you're doing coming very soon. And that I am excited to say that I am 100% confident that after this, by the time between recording this episode and it going out, that the trailer will be available for people.
Fantastic. It'll be May 1st, 2019. It's called the Christian History Almanac. And it's... 1517's first 7-day-a-week podcast. It's 5 minutes. It's sort of this day in church history. So if you like church history, I give you two or three stories, what happened, and then we end with a reading. And that reading could be some gospel poetry or... if it's someone's birthday on that date, and there's a reading like Gregory of Nazianzus, I know is May the 9th, we do a reading from him. And so it's kind of like a 5-minute, it's got some music in the background. It's produced by Christopher Gillespie of Band Books Podcast. And I think it's going to sound real nice, and it's going to be a nice little 5-minute maybe intro to your day with some church history, music, and the like.
Awesome.
I've heard the demos. It's really good.
Yeah. There's irony to it.
Yeah.
The way your voice is, it's so serious, but then you break these quirky things.
There is a little bit of fun to it. It's straightforward and to be soothing, but I do add a little bit of personality because, you know, you want to have some fun with it as well.
The daily sort of shorts, I just think, are good ideas.
Yeah.
I
mean, so I'll put the link to the trailer in there, and you can subscribe to that show with your favorite podcasting app. And then when it comes out in the first week of May, we're going to, you'll just start getting those episodes every day.
Yep.
And you can just have them on your phone.
My favorite stories from church history. So I'm having a lot of fun writing those scripts. A lot of, you know, not necessarily just the stuff you all know, but some of the fun stories. So,
well, cool. So we're picking up just right after where we ended last time, which last time we ended with the interims. The Augsburg interim was, I think, what we really ended on, and we ended with a discussion of Melanchthon's sort of
shocking.
Yeah, Melanchthon's involvement or lack of involvement in the interims. So today we're picking up around 1550. We'll probably hop over to 1555, and we're going to move our way into the Peace of Augsburg, and we're going to talk about the Reformation abroad too, outside of Germany. Dan's going to help out with that today. And so looking at 1550's timeline, it starts to, we were just talking before the show, it looks like a lot of the major players, a lot of the big guns in Germany are dying. Right? That's sort of what's happening in the 1550s.
Yeah, I mean, well, 1550s to 1560, you know, you get most of the big players will die. As Nicholas von Amsdorf, I think, dies in that period. Mm-hmm. Justus Jonas dies in that period. Melanchthon dies in that period. So some of the big names.
Lucas Cranach, the elder dies here. So there's going to be a transition. It's sort of, and I think this is one of those transitions you can see from the early Lutheran confessions to the Formula of Concord, right? The young guns, the students of Luther, Melanchthon, sort of are now picking up the reins. And they're sort of dealing with a very divided Germany, because we're talking about these interims, and we're going to talk about the Peace of Augsburg. And why would there have to be peace, I guess, is the question, right? Why is there a peace to be made?
It's worth noting at this time, the university at Jena.
Jena, yeah.
It is formed. A little college before, it's formed as a university in the 1550s, and it's going to become sort of the center of this second generation of Lutheran Orthodoxy. And Wittenberg is actually going to move a little bit towards the way of proto-pietism, and it becomes a fascinating conversation. But just as we're looking at the transition from first generation to second generation of Lutherans, the university at Jena there is really, really an important place and will become an important place, and it's starting right at the same time.
So what important events between the Augsburg interim and the Peace of Augsburg do we have to deal with, or what is the Peace of Augsburg and why are we going to lead up to it? That's my big question for the first half of this episode, is what is the Peace of Augsburg?
Well, I'll let Dan answer that, but because he wasn't here for the last recording, the listeners remember the last episode that we did in this series where we discussed the interims, and we discussed that the reason that the interims were needed was because they were dealing with a lot of things, but we spoke specifically theologically dealing with what do we do now in this in-between period, right? The time after the Small Caldic War, and I think probably in most people's mind, before the end of the Council of Trent, when some of these ideas would be decided, right? So you're in this in-between time. But the end of the Small Caldic War didn't really bring peace, if you will. I don't think it brought, and Dan and Adam can answer this better, I don't think it brought total political peace. It didn't bring theological peace. And so you have these two, the documents, landing on the second one, really they're theologically dealing with what do we tell the churches to do here in the meantime? And the Peace of Augsburg, you know, so there's still a solution that's needed. These are the interims are not solutions. Mm-hmm. They are practices for the in-between time.
If it's worth noting, for me, when it comes to the Peace of Augsburg, the Peace of Augsburg is very basically, on a very basic level, the end of the Schmalkaldic Wars. Like I would think of the Peace of Westphalia or the Peace of Vienna or the Peace of Paris, that this is just the end of that series. Now, it's a very theological document, because when it comes to how you rule the state, right, the empire and the church are still fighting with each other. And so it's a theological document, and it's going to lay things out, not only theologically, but how to maybe live, right, who's in charge of where. But it is, at its most basic, a real peace, a stop killing each other, we're not at war, the Schmalkaldic War is over. So in just a basic sense, you can think of it like any other treaty, it just happens to be really theological.
And the goal, the end goal, is very similar to what the interims were, right? It's to sort of settle who can worship under what confession and where.
Well, yeah, but the interims didn't really deal with that. They acknowledged, we have a problem here that we don't really know how to practice church. And so how do we do that in this in-between time when we've kicked out some of the Lutheran pastors, some of them have stayed, and now we're telling them that they're back to the ways of Rome, and they're... I think really with the interims, and I said this last episode, what they didn't really count on was the people. And they kind of thought that they could control the pastors and the universities, which they probably could by exiling and killing pastors and whatnot, but they didn't really count on the people objecting as much as the people objected to the changing in their now, what, 30-year practice by that point, or close to 30-year practice by that point. And so it had to do with that. How much can we compromise on both sides, right? How much can we compromise while still feeling theologically and in theological practice, while still feeling like we can hold up our heads up high? The Peace of Augsburg, it's not a good solution, though, Dan, is it? I mean, what is the solution?
Well,
it doesn't seem like a good solution.
In its very basic sense, it says you can believe whatever your prince believes.
Yeah.
So long as what your prince believes is either Catholicism or Lutheranism. So it's basically the kind of weakest, you know, middle ground to the Reformation, you know, to are we going to have lots of churches? No. Well, we'll just let one of them be. And in a way, in Germany, the Lutheran Church was the issue. So they weren't thinking about necessarily the other sects. But it's what happens when a ruler converts from Catholicism to Protestantism. What happens when the people decide, I don't want to convert, I don't want to change, right? The pressure from below, Scott, as you were just saying, is, you know, while historians might say in the early Reformation it wasn't as strong as some have made it to be, by the time we get to the 50s, 60s, 70s in the 16th century, the pressure from below is massive.
Yeah.
And as you said, they've got a rhythm of 30, 40 years of using these new forms of worship. So I think that it was a nice try, but like most, you know, sort of milquetoast political middle-of-the-road things, it's ultimately going to lead to 1618, right, which is the 30 Years' War and the first Great World War in many ways.
The defenestration of Prague.
The defenestration of Prague, exactly.
Yeah. You know, this is sort of a side note, but kind of a curious thing in the history of the Reformation. In the 1570s, when the wars between the Turks and the Habsburg Empire kind of start coming to a conclusion, or at least a temporary conclusion, the Habsburg Emperor, Maximilian at that time, employed Lutheran chaplains to go with his ambassadors to Constantinople so that they could minister to the Lutherans amongst the Habsburg bureaucracy, if you will. So it's kind of a curious history. So the Habsburgs are staunchly Catholic, but there's Lutherans amongst them, and they're recognized as legitimate.
It's become a political reality that this group just exists. And so you're going to have to do something with that part of your population that is, you know, that believes this. It's, I mean, really, when we look at histories of the Reformation, so often, especially in the German histories, we see bis 1555, right? German for up to 1555, and that's it.
Yeah.
And that's appropriate in a lot of ways. But what we're seeing is this transition, we're seeing political factors, we're seeing a legalized Lutheranism. And that's really what 1555 represents.
Right.
Peace of Augsburg legalized Lutheranism.
Yeah.
It's not the greatest idea, but it's certainly the next big idea in political statesmanship.
Well, it's not the greatest idea, because you could have grown up in a province or an area which was Roman Catholic, and you know, that brother dies, the next brother comes in, he's now your elector, your ruler.
It's like you're talking Lutheran. About the history of England. Yeah,
and
or other.
Boom, guess what? You know, you're 65 years old, you've been Roman Catholic your whole life, and
now you're
welcome
Lutheran.
To being Lutheran.
Yeah. And this is the history of what we see in England, right?
Yeah.
And this is happening at the very same time, Caleb, if, you know, just to go in that same time period, that in 1553, we're going from Henry, Mary to Elizabeth. And that's a great example of, okay, whoever the king or queen worships, whatever, you know, denomination or what have you they have, you follow. Okay, so Henry VIII, you follow, and then his son, Edward, for a very short time. But then when Mary comes to the throne, what happens? Well, we better all become Catholic.
Again.
And then when
kill
she goes,
kill
all the Protestants. And of course, this is where we get Fox's Book of Martyrs and the like. But then Elizabeth comes and, oh, wait a second.
Better
she's
kill all the Catholics.
Kill the Catholics. And it just becomes, you know, there's a way, there's a reason why.
Even
they kind
if you're
of
related to
Via Media. Yeah, exactly. So it doesn't, yeah, it's not a great idea, but,
yeah.
You know.
So this isn't a show on the history of political thought, but since I have two people here who have taught
hey,
on the history
going?
Of political
yeah.
thought for years and years and years, I've sometimes even taught myself that if people wonder why what happened in the 20th century happened, right, regarding not only the First World War and the Second World War sort of as, in my mind, a bit of a culmination to all of this, mm-hmm. but why postmodern thought comes into popularity, mm-hmm. you can kind of come back to Europe, mainland Europe, just getting really sick of getting jerked around by leaders who send their people out to die for idealistic
yeah.
things like, well, now we're Catholic, now yeah. we're Lutheran, now what? We're Calvinist, now we're this. And by you fast forward 100 years, mm-hmm. and, well, several hundred years, right? And they're just, mainland Europe, they're just tired of this.
Yeah.
They're just done. Like, we're done with this. And World War One, I mean, that's a big turning point. We go from thousands of people dying in one conflict
yeah.
to millions dying in one conflict. Then fast forward to the Second World War, and you know how you have so many millions that to this day they don't even have a full number.
Yeah, there's some symmetry here with, you know, World War One starts with the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of the House of
Habsburg.
So, and that's the same house from Charles V,
yeah.
where the whole Reformation starts. So there's some nice symmetry there, and. But absolutely, I mean, you are living through the 30 Years' War, which I mentioned, 1618 to 1648, which is like World War 0.5.
Yeah.
And it's one of
just
the first
just because they don't
times.
Have the technology.
Exactly. Yeah. Because everyone's kind of, whoa, everyone's involved.
But million people don't even know this. We're jumping the gun. Sorry, Caleb. But millions yeah. of people, a third of Europe dies during the 30 Years' War? Something like that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
From disease and from...
Plague, disease, warfare. I mean, it's an...
A third.
It's an underrated to say. It's an underrated war.
Yeah.
And it is a direct result of this Peace of Augsburg, to tie it back to that. I mean, it goes Peace of Augsburg, and then, okay, what are we going to do next?
Yeah.
30 Years' War, then Peace of Westphalia.
So for the listeners, yeah. and then Adam, go, just one more thing to say.
We're all
is
excited.
It, this. America, you know, in 2001, rightly so, 3,000 people die, and America changes the way it does everything.
Everything.
Right. Everything changes in 2001 because 3,000 people died. Can we imagine what we would do if 100 million people died over the course of 30 years, over a conflict?
Change our ideas about church?
Change our ideas about
everything.
Everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, go ahead.
Mm. Well, I'm trying to remember what I was... I was going to ask you, Dan, Stephen Toulmin.
Yes.
I think USC, died a couple of years ago. He wrote a book called Cosmopolis, and he attributes the rise of the Enlightenment, or Enlightenments.
Thank you.
And I'm going to put quotes around it, too. to the... The religious wars, especially the 30 Years' War. And he makes this point that people like Descartes, so that's 17th century, so yeah. we're a century later.
Yeah, Descartes fought in the 30 Years' War.
Yeah, and he gets out, and others, they look back at the wars of religion that result from the Reformation, mm-hmm. and they sort of collectively say, we got to find a new approach to knowledge, public knowledge.
Public knowledge, public morality, public, the church is no longer the center
yeah,
as it once was.
Yeah, we have to base it on something yeah. else.
What is it, what's it going to be?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's either,
is it going to be civic virtue? Is it going to be ancient mm-hmm. philosophies? Is it, and we know how fast these little things will just crawl yeah. in, you know, in terms of worldviews, philosophies, and the like.
Yeah.
And I think the Enlightenment, yeah, especially when you say enlightenments. Because it's not just a movement, it's all sorts of upheavals of thought and understanding, and some for good, some for ill, and absolutely.
I'm remembering why I thought that passing thought when you mentioned this connection between the Reformation and the rise of postmodernism after.
Didn't Corey Moss write a paper on that?
Maybe, but Toulmin says, because postmodernism is in many ways kind of a rejection of modernism, this sort of arrogant assumption that we can arrive at like
100% every conclusion
truth on the grounds of, to put it very generally, rationalism or empiricism and so on. So the Reformation, this is one of the interesting things with the
Or even just on the basis of prior held knowledge.
Yeah. But, I mean, the Reformation is, while it's era within the history of the church, it has huge ramifications in the history of Western civilization.
Absolutely,
And, I mean, the trajectory of it, in a way, it still influences us today.
Oh, I think
it And not just in terms of the Protestant denominations all through.
Well, we talk about these people dying, and we're like, oh, this person died, and this person died, but at the same time, you have to...
Back when it was happening, it's a serious thing. It's easy to think about it abstractly, oh, here's the number. Well,
and a lot
Luther
of
dies. Melanchthon dies.
Yeah.
And not to just highlight the 1517 Academy again, but that's... we've gotten some response that my class, taken as a historian and doing it, is looking at very much these things. Mm-hmm. You know, the theological stuff, we can get into that deep in a podcast, right, and dig into the confessions of faith and who's believing what. What I'm doing is looking at the Reformation from a very historical perspective, saying you can't get from the Middle Ages to the modern ages without going through this thing.
Yeah.
And so it's an approach that says, oh, by the way, it's intensely theological, and that's important.
Yeah.
But at the same time, as something that is intensely theological should, it's going to affect everything else.
It's rather short time period too.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of, I'm not saying it's always overlooked, but it'd be somewhat easy to overlook in a sense.
Oftentimes eclipsed by the Renaissance.
Right. Just because, you know, in terms of activity, you're talking 70 years, 60 years.
I mean, I often will talk about the Reformation century and just say 1517 to 1618, you know, basically when the war starts, Luther to, you know, 30 years.
Yeah, so 100 years.
And in that, you've got a French war of religion, French wars of religion. You've got some interesting things happen, but nothing on the scale of
this,
what's happening later or a black death in the Middle Ages. It's, relatively quiet
amazing
period.
Amazing time in history.
Yeah. And people have written about why this time in history, why did everything change, right? They call it an axial age or what have you. But with the Renaissance happening in the South and the Reformation happening largely in Northern Europe and Western Europe, why did this happen? And, you know, it's all sorts of things. And this is where we can have fun looking at the way that, you know, God's providence puts things together.
And the fullness of time.
Yeah, absolutely. The printing press happens the same time this happens. And
Not aliens.
Well, I mean, there's some tie-in to, you know, why did the gospel spread so quickly after the death of Christ? And you do have, you know, this idea of in the fullness of time. There's Pax Romana. There's road systems. It's fairly safe to sail from one place to another place, you know, without the threat of piracy and whatnot, which would not have been the case in earlier age or later age.
Yeah.
And so, you know, serendipity, providence.
So, Dan, you brought up a quick stuff about England, but there's actually just a lot happening here. You have various rulers. You have Calvinism comes to Scotland.
If you think of Calvinism coming to Scotland, you want to think of John Knox. John Knox was a Scottish fellow who moved to Geneva and studied under Calvin. And in 1559, he comes back and lands. And there's a whole history of what happens there around St. Andrews and then down into Edinburgh. But that's going to set off a very Protestant, very Calvinistic Scotland, which is not yet unified with England to the south. England to the south is being ruled by the Tudors. So Henry VIII, and then Henry VIII, Edward VI, Tudor, Mary Tudor, the Bloody Mary, so-called, and then Elizabeth. She's a Tudor as well. And so
she's kind of bloody, too.
She is kind of bloody Elizabeth Tudor.
Did she? And, I learned this somewhere, but she killed more people than Mary, right?
Well, she was also ruler from 1558 to 1603.
Mary's
instead
ruler
of
for like
5 years.
Three,
1553
years.
To 1558. Yeah. I think, it's a fact. So they're all Tudors. Now, what will end up happening is after Elizabeth, King James will come to the throne. King James is a Stuart. He's from Scotland. Wow. He's been sort of reared in this kind of world that John Knox affected, and he's going to become the king of England and Scotland, and he's going to take on the name King James the First, or King James the Sixth, if you're in Scotland. He's the guy that we have the King James Bible is named after him. And this really just shows you, one, all the stuff that's happening in England, but two, how much of it's happening from kind of political decrees, and just how important that kind of hierarchy still was in the English church. I'm sorry, I just said a lot of things about the English Reformation.
We could make it even more global, and this is when with the exception of the Roanoke colony, which fails,
yeah.
Jamestown.
I think that's harsh. I mean, it fails, but you know, they had a couple of years.
They just disappear.
Yeah,
they all die.
We all do.
Protestantism makes its way across the Atlantic.
Yeah, this is sometimes referred to as the age of international Calvinism, which is interesting that it's Calvinism, right? Because, you know, Lutheranism never caught on in England. There was kind of a strange, almost.
That is weird that it never caught on in England. I mean, you finally get a bit of religious peace in England with Elizabeth and her reign. She's reared on Melanchthonian Lutheranism.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And,
you know, it was seen as a German thing in some ways. There's a great article called The Strange Death of Lutheran England by Alec Ryrie. And some of the very first people to go outside of Germany with the Reformation went to Scotland, went to the University of St. Andrews, where I'm an alum. This is Hamilton.
Patrick Hamilton.
And George Wishart. And these were Lutheran guys teaching and becoming quite popular in Scotland. And they were killed. And it kind of fizzled out.
Oh.
And then Lutheran became this, ooh, that's no good.
We don't want to be that.
But there's something else.
Yeah.
And so it just
becomes be that because it's too Catholic? It's not Protestant enough? Or what's...
Oh, well, at that time with Hamilton, it's, no, you guys are just against the status quo. You're just going to mess
things
up.
And I'd even say that in England, I mean, Cranmer is very Lutheran in his theology.
Yeah,
he's
theologically.
Very theologically Lutheran. And I'd say he's very Melanchthonian theologically Lutheran.
Yeah.
There's very similar phrases between, in his writings, you can hear the Augsburg Confession, you can hear the Loci Communis, you can hear a lot of things.
For the audience, if you think of this time period, go to 1563 and 39 articles.
Right.
And that's the Confession of Faith that Cranmer's really writing, and it becomes the English Church's Confession of Faith. So right in the same time period.
But it just doesn't catch on.
It doesn't, and partly because the name Lutheran meant...
German,
rabble-rouser, gonna mess things up. Yeah, and so, but Calvinism, you know, it's not too dissimilar to today, right? I have friends who are Reformed, or, you know, what is it? I'm a Reformed Baptist or a Calvinistic this or that. And it kind of has lent itself to, you know, sort of you add it on to your theological distinctives. And Lutheranism didn't lend itself to that as much. And because Calvinism has that kind of wiggle room, it moves easier around the globe, frankly, in the 16th century.
Yeah, well, it is skipping ahead because we do have something in 1560.
I'm sorry. We get excited. What else do you want to know?
Well, because I was going to say also in 1563, the Heidelberg Catechism.
That's like the most important. 1563 is like one of the banner years.
Yeah.
Someday there's going to be an organization called 1563. Generations from now, though.
We should copyright it now.
let's trademark that right now.
Careful.
Right now.
Yeah, 63 because it's you have 39 articles, you have Heidelberg Catechism, you have Fox's Book of Martyrs, and Trent begins. And so everyone's sort of, 63 is the year of, you know, second generation Reformation, you know, beginnings. I'm sorry, Trent concludes in 63.
Can we back up?
Yes, we do. Yeah, we need to back up.
Just 3 years?
Sorry. Well, and maybe two before that too, or to just get to what happens before these 3 years. But yeah, 1560, Melanchthon dies.
Yeah, I mean, what's that?
Yawn.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, this is what you're talking about, right? This is the period where all the guys are dying. He died a year after Calvin. Calvin died in 1559.
Oh, I thought it was later than that.
Was it later?
You're probably right, though. I mean, this is not my thing. I know when Melanchthon died. That's 1560. I mean, it's interesting that Melanchthon...
1564.
Yeah, I thought it was a little after. Melanchthon... in this last couple years of life, is very productive theologically. I mean, I think he writes another catechism, which is I think isn't that the one where it's sort of like his catechism on catechesis?
It's like on catechesis, and it's kind of sort of weird. So for a project actually for Jeff Mallins and a class I had with him, I translated the introduction of that, and it is weird because it's directed at, like, I would say people in grammar school for him still, so anywhere between like middle school and high school.
Mm-hmm.
But like the whole beginning is why we do catechesis, and then the beginning of each section is why we would catechize about this one. So it's different than Luther, who just jumps into question and answer, right? Melanchthon takes the time to say, actually, first I wanted you to learn these three Greek words, and then and that's because this is tied to the history of education, and the history of education dictates that this is how I'm going to do it. And then you get into a very similar order to Luther. You start with the Ten Commandments, and right before, why would we even learn the Ten Commandments? And here's the history of education and the Ten Commandments again.
Well, you see him doing, and this is, I wrote on this a while ago, just in a blog though, but you see him doing grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic. Yes. Point by point in this catalog.
It's like, there's a reason he's called the teacher of Germany, the preceptor of Germani. He knows educational theory, and I mean, he's a master at that.
He's going to teach you the words, what the words mean. He's going to teach you how to use the words, and then he's going to teach you how to argue the words, and then you go. And so that's kind of interesting that he does that. And then the last edition of the Loci is a year later in 1559. It's not a major change. It's pretty much a continuation of the changes that began way back in 1543. It is the edition, though, that for English readers, it is one of the editions that you can buy in English. And so I think that's interesting. You can get the very first one, 1521. You can get the very last one, 1559. So that's kind of interesting. If you want to know Melanchthon's thought at the beginning of his career, Melanchthon's thought at the end of his career, you can get those two transitions.
Hmm.
And he dies having spent and we've said this several times on this show, having spent the most of the latter half of his life fighting other Lutherans with wars of words, as we've said before. Luther accused he and Agricola of having a war of words in the late 1520s, and this really never ends for Melanchthon after that, from that point on, especially after the death of Luther.
Well, yeah, ramps up after Luther.
Ramps up with the Gnasios, with the authentic Lutherans. And he dies, with his son-in-law by his side, who's a physician. And I've said it before on the show. begging for God to deliver him from the ragings of the theologians, which I relate to a little bit.
It was pre-Twitter.
So
pre-Twitter.
Which has really only gotten worse with Twitter.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's an interesting thing. His students are primarily the ones that'll... And it's funny, within the LCMS sort of view of history, we often call the people who write the Formula of Concord Luther students. But the reality is that the people who write the Formula of Concord are, on the whole, Melanchthon students. And so it's Melanchthon students who not all of them completely agree with him on every point. You see that in the formula, but they are his students that write the formula.
I think in a chapter you and I wrote that'll come out in a book this fall, right? It's this August?
August.
Yeah, you see some of that explanation of why the attacks on Melanchthon ramp up, because during their friendship, a lot of their friendship was built upon defending each other from various people.
They have sort of this this thing that you might call a classically good friendship, that even though they disagree, they don't get on Twitter and say Dan's a jerk. Mm-hmm. They do disagree, but they don't do that publicly, even when asked.
Mm-hmm.
Even when asked. Now, like we said, I think his last episode of the episode before, Melanchthon unfortunately does a little bit of that at Luther's funeral, which is, in my opinion, a lapse in character. But other than that, it's difficult to find a letter where Luther criticizes Melanchthon to somebody other than Melanchthon. Like, he'll write a letter to Melanchthon criticizing him.
There's a way in which the history, sort of after the death of Melanchthon, the history of the development of Lutheran identity up through 1580, is a question of what do we do with Luther and what do we do with Melanchthon?
Yeah.
And these two men who were together, Irenic, and they could figure out how to argue back and forth, the juniors just couldn't get along with each other in some ways. And so we see some of these tensions that were held, sometimes, not well in the first generation that the second generation kind of loses. Yeah. And so Luther's, you know, sort of famous analogy of the drunk falling over on either side of the horse. Yep. We tend to see it back and forth, but yeah. It was the personality of Luther and Melanchthon together that could really kind of hold that stuff together.
Bob Kolb does a great job with that.
Yeah, Bob Kolb is the king of everything last half of the 16th century who were Lutherans. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's cool. And then since we talked about Melanchthon's catechism and we did talk about that it's substantial that the Heidelberg Catechism comes up, I just wanted to take a second to compare it a little bit to Luther's small catechism in order and style, because it does vary quite a bit. It's immediately question and answer, so you can already see that it's got a very similar purpose, right? Where it's short, like Luther's small catechism.
And you're comparing it to the Heidelberg Catechism.
Yes.
Ursinus's Heidelberg Catechism, mm-hmm. 1563. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas I think stylistically and the purpose of it, they're similar. I mean, but the ordering is different. The beginning of the Heidelberg Catechism has you reflect on you as a sinner. I think it's labeled misery. And it has you say the law is, that's the first answer in there. How do I know that I'm a sinner? How do I know that I'm miserable?
The law. God tells me. Yeah.
Whereas Luther's brings you to there, but through the Ten Commandments, right? And so then there's a lot more question and answer about that. And then it moves into this section on how was I delivered? And you get the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, and the work of all three persons in salvation, baptism and the supper, which are going to differ from Luther's sections on baptism and the supper, as we've already talked about on various episodes. And then what I think is interesting is the last part of the Heidelberg Catechism is the Ten Commandments. That's the part that's completely reversed from the way the Lutherans do it, and it's under the section called gratitude. Or thanksgiving to God. And the Ten Commandments are seen not as that law that kills you, but that thanksgiving, the response to God, which is a different setup from the way... I just think you see the law in the gospel here, but you see a significantly different setup.
Well, the way it's set up is sort of the, you know, to use one of a more modern Calvinistic way of talking it, the guilt, grace, gratitude, that's how the Heidelberg Catechism is set up. And so when you take those very basic parts of any catechism, in this case, the Ten Commandments of the Lord's Prayer, it's going to be for them under the gratitude, right? It's the emphasis on the third use or what have you. So I think that's why we find it there. It's just a different working out of a catechism that you're right, shows us, hey, a real theological distinctive if we look carefully. Like I said, we say the law, gospel, and oftentimes in those communities today, you'll hear guilt, grace, gratitude.
Yes.
And that's the way. And when you hear that, just think, oh, you can think, if depending how you're feeling that day, you can think, oh, law, gospel, law, or law, gospel, third use.
Like how much trouble do you want to get into? I mean, classically, Lutheranism's been described as a law, gospel, theology, right? Yes. Law, gospel, stop, theology. And Dan's right. To put it in modern terms, guilt, grace, gratitude is a good way of describing the way a Calvinist view or approach to theology. Now, there becomes a problem within Lutheranism when you adopt some of those categories and you start saying, well, our theology is law, gospel, law, which is never, it's not historically been seen that way or described that way. And it is why some of this is coming up again now with some controversy, because we have a history of trying to do that and then fighting against it and then settling it back on law gospel. And so we're coming back around again. I cringe a little bit when you say we share law gospel theology with the Calvinists.
Well, I'm trying to be friendly.
We start in the same order.
Mike Horton and...
Yeah, I want to be friendly too, but I want to acknowledge that as Luther approaches the Decalogue and the Small Catechism, it's the only time that I'm familiar with in Christian history when the Decalogue is taught with a positive spin on it. In other words, you see more than threats in the way Luther... You do see threats, but you see more than threats in the way Luther explains the various commandments. You see promises there, too. And that's unique. You can teach your child the Ten Commandments from Luther's Small Catechism, and it's not a depressing day. And that's unique within Christendom, I think. I could be wrong. Jim Nestegan makes this argument. It's not unique to me, but he makes this argument. It's why if you read Nestegan Ferdy's Free to Be, where they sort of take Luther's explanations and expand on it a little bit, you really can teach that to your children, and it's not a bad day. And I think there's a unique character to that, where the Ten Commandments are always leading you to the gospel. Mm-hmm. They're always leading you into the gospel. They're not just there to condemn you. They're not just there to make you guilty. They do that, of course. The law always condemns, right? They do that, of course. But they're there to lead you to Christ. And in that way, Lutheranism is law gospel because it's specifically Christocentric in a way that, in my opinion, Calvinism will never be. Sorry.
No, I agree.
I'll go back to looking at
truth. No, and in many ways, this is the conversation that's happening in the 50s, in the 1550s and 60s, whether it be sometimes with Lutherans and Catholics, like the colloquy at Worms, or with, Reformed and Lutherans, saying, are we or aren't we together on this? Mm-hmm. And what Scott just laid out was the argument, the Lutheran argument for saying, we get it, you're close, but it's not the same.
That's right.
And what's interesting today is how many Lutherans talk like the Reformed. Yeah. And you're right, it's just a godly fit. It happens about every century and then it winds back down. But, it's something important, I think, for Lutherans to recognize. At the same time, a Heidelberg Catechism, it's a beautiful catechism. If you're, just in terms of literary, and it's got these law gospel allusions and frankly just law gospel sections, mm-hmm. I think you're right. The problem with it is its order. But if you just look at it in terms of how does it explain this, there's a reason why, Lutherans, I think, have a long tradition of saying, of all the Reformed confessions, yeah. I'll take this one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not the canons of Dort,
yeah.
Not Westminster.
Yeah.
Not this one is the one we can dance the closest with, or Sinus got the closest to us.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
Cool.
All right.
Well, I think the only we're pretty much at time, and so the only other thing I just want to
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Of the Thinking Fellows, because I don't get to be on here as we've just established very often, as it was the garage. The same time all this is happening, for me, one of the biggest things that happens is the printing of the Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible is the first Bible published. It's 1560. It's the first Bible published in English. It's called the Geneva Bible because it represents, it has Bible notes in it that represent Calvin's theology.
Right.
And it brings it to England. And then before the King James Bible comes, 50 years later, it goes everywhere. And it sets the tone for the study Bible, right? It's the first study Bible. And I find that to be terribly ironic in terms of sola scriptura, in terms of the tradition. What do you guys think just about the tradition of the Geneva Bible, of the Bible getting in people's hands? Was this a good thing? Do we need more Bible notes?
I think Adam contributed to the Concordia Self-Study Bible.
Well, this is partly just to condemn him, is why I brought it up.
The Lutheran Study Bible.
Lutheran Study
Bible. Yeah, and replaced the Concordia Study Bible.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It's a very underrated way of seeing how theology can get places.
Well, it's interesting for traditions that say, hey, it's really important for you to read this stuff.
Mm-hmm. With nothing else. Yeah. Yeah. Sola scriptura.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, it's very important for you to read this stuff and then come up with your own questions and then ask somebody mm-hmm. who studied more, right? The thing that I used to like study Bibles quite a bit because they kind of, if you don't know a lot, they make it easier to teach.
Yeah.
But, the biggest problem I see with them now is that they ask the questions before you have the questions. Mm. And really one of the things that reading scripture, sola scriptura isn't necessarily scripture bare.
Yeah.
But what it is, and again, Melanchthon in me is going to come out here, is that you ought to at least, say you're studying Romans, you ought to at least read Romans one time through on its own and let it present its own themes and its own questions that you then go back to study. Now, when you go back to study them, you might bring in, the insights from the people that helped write a study Bible. You might bring in other things. But you ought to at least go through one time before you do any of that and let the text present its own themes and its own questions and then get the help with those themes and questions as needed.
As we were talking about the Heidelberg Catechism, I was just thinking about this because this seems like possibly an argument possibly, that this whole study Bible and this kind of way of doing a kind of odd sola scriptura is actually a Reformed thing that later Lutherans bit onto and pretended it was part of their heritage when in fact it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was part of the other tradition. And I'm not saying this for tribalism or to be, you know, the true this or that, but just to say, hey, if we're going to do history, it can show us some interesting things. And if you want to talk who's got the right to saying who's done what, well, there's a record there.
Even the boards that oversee the translations of a lot of modern translations are predominantly Calvinist. The ESV, the NIV, the...
Translation alone. Yeah. But with Geneva, the Geneva Bible, we're talking the first time study notes.
Yeah.
And quite, you're right. This is about, right? It tells you what the question is and then tells you the answer.
I like them for like geography.
Oh, sure. They can be
like
helpful.
Well, it's going to lead you. It's going to... The questions that it asks by giving you answers, right, is going to lead you down a path on anything that you're reading. I mean, the minute your eye jumps down to the note as you're reading, you're now looking for the note in the passage rather than the other way around.
I'm pretty certain that Tim LaHaye, the author of the Left Behind series, every night when he was saying his prayer, said a special prayer for John Nelson Darby, who came out with one of the first, and Scofield, who came out with the first study Bibles in America that became popular.
Was it Ryrie?
Ryrie was part of this, Scofield, and Darby, and these were the dispensationalists. Hmm. And why did that become the theology in America in the 20th century? Study Bibles. So,
well, that's what my grandma.
There's my warning as a historian.
Well,
it's
how my grandma got to be. I don't even think she knew she was a dispensationalist, but it's how she got to be a dispensationalist.
Yeah, because the study notes lead you right in that.
Watching
direction.
TBN with her, I think probably Ryrie or something, study Bible in her lap, learning dispensationalism as the core to all theology, not Christ.
It's exciting stuff.
Yeah.
It's just, you know,
it's just not the gospel.
Yeah.
Well, speaking about not the gospel, though.
Well, the Reformers were guilty of the same thing. The Reformers, when they got on the book of Revelation, just to be fair, they could get kind of wacky. And it was the one place
where... Luther did think it was ending in his lifetime.
Well, everyone thinks that. But in terms where we tend to go weird, we tend to go weird in the same places, and that's the book of Revelation, whether it's TBN today or even, you know, some of the Lutheran guys, they... in the second generation too, once the older guys died off and they could write what they really wanted to, you know, then it started getting into some pretty, pretty wacky stuff.
Interesting. That's kind of funny. We should do a show with Dan. We've done it on eschatology with you, haven't we? We should do it again.
You did. You were on there.
I love eschatology. It's like the true crime genre of theology. Like, everyone's a little bit embarrassed that they like it, but if you're into it, you're just really into it. And, you know, it's fine. It's not the most respected, but...
Well, cool. Well, so next episode, we're going to pick up basically with this second generation of Reformers. We have Jacob Andre, Martin Chemnitz are going to be popping up, and we're going to start seeing significant publications from them and their effort towards Formula of Concord and uniting... Their attempt to unite Lutheranism, really. So, and that's going to be next episode. So, thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed the show, please go subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. Give us a review on iTunes, even if you listen somewhere else. It really does help search results and things like that. And do remember, we did have some stuff that we plugged at the beginning of the show. Go subscribe to that new show, Christian History Almanac, and do... Sign up for Academy lectures. You don't have to take every course, but you should get every course into your inbox so you can see them when they come up. All right, we'll catch you next time.